We're going to start in just a few minutes. This is for people listening at home on WGXC. Give us 3 or 4 minutes while people find their way in. Welcome all. To those who are here for the first time, I'll introduce myself. I'm Jeffrey Leppendorf, Executive Director of the Flowchart Foundation, where we open new possibilities for discovery, thought, and connection by exploring poetry and the interrelationships of various art forms, including translation. Happy Translation Month, everybody. Woo! by exploring poetry and the interrelationships of various art forms as guided by the legacy of John Ashbery. For those here, do when we're done, take a little time. We have a fun exhibit of various bits of Ashberiana from the Ashbery Resource Center, which occupies the entire second floor in the basement of this building. If you are a scholar of the New York School or Ashbery or a creative who would like to spend time with the stuff here, give us a call. We love showing it off, and you could work with our amazing collection upstairs. Today is a really exciting program, and it's coincidental that we're doing this for Translation Month. I realized that after we scheduled it. It's just a nice coincidence. We think of every day as Translation Day. We all live our lives translating everything we do, really. And you know, as our world continues to shrink due to technology, there is one way to expand our world, and that is through reading it. And the way we read it is through translation. So the folks in back of me are terribly important for us to be able to read the entire world. And I'm going to get out of the way in just a moment after introducing Eric M. Becker, who is a writer and literary translator, as well as the digital director and senior editor of Words Without Borders, which is your launching pad for all things translation, if you own a computer. So if you somehow don't know Words Without Borders, Eric may tell you a bit more, but you want to run home and bring it up online. He himself is a recipient of all manner of fellowships and residencies. I'll just read a few. NEA, Fulbright Commission, Louis Armstrong House Museum. He's earned a Penheim Translation Fund grant, was a 2015 Man Booker International finalist. He's published translations of numerous writers from Brazil, Portugal, and Lusophone Africa. His work has appeared in many, many places, New York Times, Foreign Affairs, Lit Hub, Freeman's, Electric Literature's Recommended Reading, all over the place. My great pleasure to welcome Eric Becker.
Hello, everybody. Thank you, Jeffrey, for that wonderful introduction. Yes, I'm Eric of Words Without Borders. Really glad to be here in this space, in this wonderful space, working with the Flowchart Foundation on this event. You're in for a real treat here with our readers and translators. A few words first about Words Without Borders. It is the premier destination for a global literary conversation. Founded in 2003, the magazine's mission is to expand access to international writing and create a bridge between readers, writers, and translators. And over our 20-year history, we've published more than 400, 4,600 big difference there, isn't there? Contributors from over 140 countries, 140 languages, including Nobel laureates like Olga Tokarczuk and international sensations like Elena Ferrante and Han Kang, while also centering writers working in indigenous, endangered, and other world languages that have historically been at the margins of the literary world. If you're interested, you can visit us at wordswithoutborders.org every weekday for new fiction, nonfiction, poetry, audio, and video readings. So we're here today for a reading and discussion around poetry, and more specifically, the translation of poetry, both as an artistic practice and in terms of reading, reaching and impacting audiences. And so I would like us to start with some readings, and I will introduce our very first reader here on my right. Kathleen Heil is a writer, translator, and choreographer-performer, originally from New Orleans, living in Berlin since 2015. She is the translator of The Loveliest Vowel Empties, Merritt Oppenheim's collected poems, out last year from World Poetry Books, and the recipient of grants from the National Endowment for the Arts, Berlin Senate, and the German Translators Fund. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, BOM, The Threepenny Review, and other journals, and her debut poetry collection will be published in the UK later this year by Moist Books. Kathleen.
Is this okay? Thank you, Eric, for that introduction and to flowchart. I know it's also for
I'm going to jump in because while some other folks are coming, come on in, lots of seats. I forgot another important thank you, two important thank yous. One is we are live streaming on WGXC, Radio for Open Ears. Thank you, WGXC, woo, our local wonderful radio station. And we are also, in addition to being co-presented by Words Without Borders today, co-presented by Art Oh My Writers, an absolutely remarkable writer's residency that takes place over at Art Oh My, 17 minutes away from here, exactly, driven it enough times to know. I have the great pleasure of directing as well the music program there, and I'm on the board of the writers program, but a unique feature of Art Oh My Writers is that we not only invite exceptional writers, but as well exceptional translators on equal footing. So a little plug for Art Oh My. And now back to you, Kathleen.
That's a perfect transition. Thank you, Jeffrey, and to Flowchart, Art Oh My, and Words Without Borders. I'm going to read four poems today by an extraordinary German language poet named Marie T. Martin, who was born in 1982 and died in 2020, and was born in Freiburg, and her 2020 poetry collection, Rückruf, is what I'll be reading from. I'll read the second and the fourth of the poems in her German before I read my translation in the English. And her publisher in Leipzig, Poetenladen, has just published her collected writings this fall, which is called Der Winter dauerte 24 Jahre. And she wrote, in addition to poetry, radio plays, prose, as an extraordinary poet, which you'll see very shortly. Without further ado, these are poems by Marie T. Martin in my translation from Rückruf. Letter in April. Do you still receive letters from the dead? I'm writing you in the year after your death. Without eyes, what do you see? Here, the blue bleeding shrub and glimmer weed grow, later revealing themselves. Which sentences would have been important? Do you still write letters? I'm writing to myself the year I was born, a painted scroll unfurled in a parking lot, the calligraphy of tires. Have you gotten older? Does the passing subway car see you? Does a maple tree hold you in between? Promise me you'll stay awake. Promise me a speech for the soul in an arrangement of white hawthorn and juniper. Promise me you'll wake. Promise me never to leave you. And I'm sure there's probably some poetry nerds like me in the audience and or tuning in live streaming, and you might notice that the title of that poem mimics that of Inga Christensen's The Wonderful Danish Poet, 1979 collection, and then also there's some echoes of Keats in there. It's really beautiful, beautiful, interesting poems. I think there is, we'll probably talk more about this later, but I do think there is a kind of, at least for me, falling in love that happens with the text that also facilitates then coming into contact with the work and translation. I'll read this poem first in German. This is called Schichten. Ich erscheine dir immer im Schlaf, bin eine Verstörung, ein Silberstör, der mit einem Flossenschlag deine Träume teilt. In Wachheit und tieferen Schlaf, in Erdbeben und Gewissheit, in Unsicherheit und die Unsicherheit dahinter. Ich erscheine dir immer im Schlaf, bin dein jüngeres, späteres Ich, bin das Quellwasser aus deinen Zellen, bin eine Empörung. Straight up. I always come to you while sleeping, malignant, a silver sturgeon that with a whip of its fins cuts your dreams in half. In waking and deep sleep, amid tremors and certainty, in uncertainty and the uncertainty beneath. I always come to you while sleeping. I am your younger, later self, the water springing from your cells, indignant. Postcard. Here is like nowhere. The grass gleams. Here is how it could be everywhere. Voices soar, weaving into each other. You don't need to put your hands up in defense. From time to time, the rain falls upward and you're flying, head down, into fields of clouds like before when you were ruled by the great Mulan. Slowly, with a crack, the snail shell breaks. You don't need it anymore. Here is like no other place. The maple tree has grown. Have you settled in its boughs like a beetle or like light? Do you still have a phone? Are you at home using the telegraph services in its roots? Ants tap out messages on the wood. Mycelia pass on stories, an array of tales full of newfound characters. Here is how it could be if your ribs weren't bound shut. Is this still your number? And I'll read one final poem, but I'll do also a short plug for Words Without Borders, because that poem and another one that I have translated will be in their pages. So I have this experience oftentimes at poetry readings of feeling like the speed of sound is faster than my brain can take in the visuals. So if you'd like to return to her work, please do check out not only, of course, my translations, but all of these extraordinary translator writers' work that have gathered here today. Last poem I'll read in the German and then in the English. Innerraum. Der Abhang, auf dem du hinunterrutschst, bis du endlich springst in lebendige Linien findest, was du Grenze nennst, gibt es nicht. Dieses Ich ein Flirren, eine windige Ebene voller schimmernder Ähren, vielfarbige Gestalten, von nichts verwaltet, aber bewegt, vom Hier und Fortgehen, von Atem und Abstand hinein. In das Pulsierende unten und oben, in dem etwas überdrauert, älter als Ahnen, als Adressen, als deine alarmbereiteten Adern und die Angst, du oder die anderen wären nun nicht mehr fassbar. Der Farn ragt über deine Arme, der Flieder, über dir der Melan wieder und wieder, damit du dich erinnerst. Internal Expanse. The slope down which you slide until you finally jump and find vibrant lines which you call borders. There's nothing there, this shimmering self, an agile plane full of gleaming tufts, multicolored figures, governed by nothing but moved by the staying and going, by breath and breadth within. In that pulsing under and over in which something survives, older than ancestors, than addresses, than your ever alert arteries and anxieties, you or the others would no longer be possible to grasp. The fern soars over your arms, the lilacs. Overhead, the kite lilts and lilts, so that you'll remember. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing those with us, Kathleen. That was amazing. Our next reader is John Keane. John is the author, co-author, and translator of a handful of books, including Annotations and Counter-Narratives, both published by New Directions. Counter-Narratives received an American Book Award, a Lannan Literary Award, a Republic of Consciousness Prize, and a Wyndham Campbell Prize for Fiction. His most recent publication, Punks, New and Selected Poems, received the 2022 National Book Award for Poetry, the Tom Gunn Award for the from the Publishing Triangle, and a Lambda Literary Award for Gay Poetry. A 2018 MacArthur Fellow, he is Distinguished Professor at Rutgers University, Newark. John, welcome.
Thank you so much, Eric. And many thanks to our hosts and sponsors and to everyone who's here today to hear poetry in translation. You can never have enough poetry in translation. So I'm going to read a few poems. Most of them are fairly short, by the contemporary Afro-Brazilian writer Ricardo Aleixo. And so I'll start with this one in Portuguese. Rondô da Ronda Noturna. Quanto pobre negro, quanto negro avô, quanto avô morto, quanto morto. How many poor black, how many black targets, how many targets dead, how many dead one. Obacoso, Xango, Obacoso, cobre a cabeça com sua coroa de cobre e chega, botando a pedra do raio, tudo brilhando nela e tudo mudado em segredo, todas as luas para ele. Elefante que anda com pote de rei, cavalo que manda e desmanda como um rei, pantera preta, senhor rei do Agassu, Aganju, que bloqueia o rio e queima a chuva com o raio. Oba Koso. This is a religious poem. Xangô, Oba Koso, covers his head with his copper crown and arrives, bearing the lightning stone, everything gleaming in him, everything transformed in secret, all loas for him. Elephant that walks with a kingsly bearing, horse that commands and disbands like a king, black panther, lord king of Agassu, Aganju, who blocks the river and fires the rain with lightning. And this is a political poem. Disease as metonymy. Workers of St. John Del Rey Mining Company in Nova Lima, Minas Gerais, boast of its origin. Miners, also known as mineros twice over, it's a little Brazilian joke, but disbelieve that living is worth nothing. They die early before understanding, for example, the spelling of pneumo ultra microscopic silicoso volcanoconiosis, which is equal to silicosis, as those who stay alive simply say. Lema. Tem que ter palavra para ser humano. Tem que ser humano para ter palavra. Lema. You have to have words to be human. You have to be human to have words. Donna Haraway. He goes there. One day I sat Mother Nature in my lap when the thing was flowing, hand here, tongue over there, the pleasure giving pitilessly in the face of guilt. Mama Nature says to me, point blank, totally inside her with that sexy voice that was hers alone, Ricardo, dear son, beyond this conversation of return to Pindorama, patriarch, matriarch, everything's vice versa, everything's equal, only the form of the thing between the thighs changes. Who gives orders? And she finished up, but to my surprise, I'm tired myself of being treated like a goddess, primitive mother, primeval female, and such. I prefer being a cyborg, electronic body, mutant, without nexus nor sex, defined, a walking metamorphosis. And I'll end with this one. Oh, no, actually. After listening to Cecil Taylor, It isn't a question of always being strong or weak, nor even of my feeling eventually weak or strong, but of me knowing a sound that life plays in intensities that vary on the edge between molto pianissimo, so low it almost cannot be heard, and molto fortissimo. The question isn't really who I am, it's yes, how do I sound? And I'll tell you the ending of that poem in English bedeviled me for weeks. And then I'll end with this one. And I'll just read the beginning in the Portuguese so you can hear his play. So it's a playful poem. A serpente. A serpente morde a própria cauda. A serpente pensa que morde a própria cauda. A serpente apenas pensa que morde a própria cauda. A serpente morde a própria cauda que pensa. A serpente morde a própria cauda suspensa. A serpente pensa que a própria cauda morde. Okay, so you hear the play. So this is the English. The snake. The snake bites its own tail. The snake thinks that it bites its own tail. The snake only thinks that it bites its own tail. The snake bites its own tail that it thinks up. The snake bites its own hanging tail. The snake thinks that its own tail bites. The snake thinks that its own head. The snake thinks that its own tail bites. The snake thinks with its own head. The snake dreams that it simulates its own hiss. Right, and I will say, we'll get to the silva and selva are very close, right? Hiss and woods. The snake dreams it's another snake simulating its own dreams and hisses. The snake thinks and hisses a jungle within, silva selva. The snake dreams that it thinks and in the dream thinks that it's snake, that snakes dream. The snake thinks that it dreams and in the dream thinks that snakes think. The snake bites without thinking that it can. The snake thinks that it bites its own cause. The snake thinks and bites its own cause. The snake thinks and bites only what it thinks. The snake thinks that it thinks and it bites what it thinks. The snake bites what it thinks and what it bites. The snake thinks what the snake thinks. The snake thinks of itself as snake. The snake thinks of itself being what it thinks. The snake thinks what it snake what snakes think. The snake bites what the snakes what the snake bites. So what the snake thinks. The snake bites what snakes bite. The snake bites what it can. The snake thinks of biting itself. The snake bites without thinking of what it can. The snake thinks without thinking what it bites and what it can. The snake bites what it bites. The snake bites while it can. The snake thinks without words. The snake doesn't think only of snake words. The snake doesn't only bite snake words. The snake can do what it can without words. The snake bites what it can without fearing words. The snake fears from tip to tail its own head. The snake utters its own sentence. The snake bites its own head. Thank you.
Amazing. That was, terrific. Yolande Scudder, our next reader, recently completed her PhD at the University at Albany with a focus on postcolonial Algerian poetry and translation. Her poetry and her translations have been featured in Poems for the Millennium, the University of California Book of North African Literature, and many other publications. She was co-editor of the University of Oxford book Marivaudage, Théorie et Pratique d'un Discours, and she is currently teaching creative writing. Yolande, welcome.
Thank you. I love a Sunday with poetry and translation. Is this good? The mic is good? Okay. So I'm going to read one slightly longer poem by Jean Sénac, a 20th century Francophone Algerian poet, kind of considered the poet of the Algerian Revolution. And it is from Préface à Vaincre. So I'll read the French first, and then I'll read the English. Sur la même crête recluse, Antonin Artaud, René Char. À jamais l'idine Benchek, cruelle éclipse de l'âme, Rachid Bey. 1. Quelle sauvage racine faites-vous surgir du soleil que mon pied se mêle au poème? Route hasardeuse, le mot et trace notre certitude. T'avoir tant cherché ce pot d'eau dans la paume, l'instant du paysage, seul recours contre notre mort? 2. Ne périssons pas. Essayons de tenir une strophe, une autre, un grave de flûte tenace jusqu'au raccord. Le coq, ou plutôt cette frénésie d'oiseaux sur le square, mais le soleil incertain. Ne périssons pas. Un café, le radeau des visages, la paix dérisoire d'un corps, périssoire fruité, toute la mer a invité à chaque flaque. Du moins, un lit nous accueille, l'horreur se tapit le printemps d'un livre. Ne périssons pas. Ève parle
dans l'insoutenable silence de nos pas. 3. Non recours, la courte paille du champ gagne, ami, d'un souffle décrasse ses pores, instaure un concile sans phrase pour une révolution sans croque. Lune ou Mars, à peine sur le roc le fragile débit d'un ongle. Plus rien n'est débattu, battu. Le mot « perpétuel orgasme des merveilles » est habité. 4. Savoir qu'il existe au buscla un arc de pupille plus sûr que tout leur compte à rebours. 5. En novembre 1969 à Alger, toute révolution lézardée, bazardée, jeunesse et poésie n'ayant plus que le droit à l'irrémissible impuissance, affûtèrent leur plaie pour une salve d'avenir et s'en retournèrent au gouffre. Régnez, épicés, plaquez vos néons sur ces fous de l'amour roi. Vigile. 6. Ni comme un comité de gestion, ni comme les victoires du Vietnam, la Palestine, n'en parlons pas. Ni comme l'abolition de la peine de mort, ni comme tous les coms de Nesval, ni comme tous les beaux coms de ni comme les beaux comme l'Autréamont, ni comme les posters de James Dean, du Che, de Huey Newton, ni comme les nus de Kadou, ni comme Aïcha, Iye, non. Tout simplement belle comme la raison de vivre, d'écrire, de lutter. Que m'apporte une frêle brindille lorsque je t'aime et que tu m'aimes, pauvre amour à peine croisé. 7. Nous savons bien ici qu'il nous manque une vertèbre. Nous savons bien, nous qui sommes de la plus étroite racine, de la plus précise rocaille, que pour toucher le ciel, il faut durer debout et dénuder sans doute. Ô évidence, dans ce creux de notre être, ce vide révulsant de la conscience, dans ce manque de nos vertèbres, alors que nous avançons, courbés, titubants et glorieux, pour que passe la moelle, la trame et le cosmos. Nous savons bien ici qu'il faut placer le mot le plus exact pour la connexion la plus proche, le mot à inventer, à construire, à voler. Dans quel dieu, quelle foule ? La vertèbre transfigurée. Pour l'instant, parmi tant d'abois, veillons à nos chevilles. Prenons garde à nos frères, prenons garde à nos espérances, prenons garde à notre propre transfiguration. Ô Jacques, Patrick, Ahmed, Mustapha, Mohamed, César Vallejo, oh, un peu de salive sur cette page, pour tenir une heure, encore une, jusqu'au père incertain, le soleil, l'oiseau Taous, le mot. The English. On the same secluded crest, Antonin Artaud, René Char. To Jamel Eddine Benchek, cruel eclipse of the soul, Rachid B. 1. What savage root do you pull from the sun that my foot tangles with the poem? Hazardous root, the word and traces are certainty. To have searched for you so, this little bit of water in the palm, the instant of the landscape, the only recourse against our death? 2. Let's not perish. Let us try to hold a strophe, another, the baseline of a tenacious flute to the coupling, the rooster, or rather this frenzy of birds on the square, but the uncertain sun. Let's not perish. A cafe, the raft of faces, the derisory piece of a body, fruited canoe, the whole sea to invent at each puddle. At least a bed welcomes us. The horror lies low, the springtime of a book. Let's not perish. Eve speaks in the unbearable silence of our steps. 3. No recourse, the short straw of song. Win, my friend, with one breath, scour these pores. Establish a council without sentences for a revolution without teeth. Moon or Mars, barely on the rock, the fragile debit of a fingernail. Nothing is debated anymore, battered. The word perpetual orgasm of marvels is inhabited. 4. Know that he exists in the buscla, an arc of pupils so sure that all their sums are backwards. 5. In November 1969, in Algiers, all revolution cracked, scrapped, youth and poetry having nothing left but the right to irremissible powerlessness, sharpened their wound for a salvo of the future, and turned themselves toward the depths. Rain, shopkeepers, smack your neon lights over these men mad with marua, watchmen. 6. Nor like a management committee, nor like the victory of Vietnam. Palestine, don't speak of it. Nor like the abolition of the death penalty, nor like all the likes of Nesval, nor like the beautiful like of L'Autréamont, nor like the posters of James Dean, of Che, of Huey Newton, nor like the nudes of Kadou, nor like Aïcha, Iye, no. Simply beautiful like the reason to live, to write, to fight, brought to me by a frail reed, as I love you and you love me, poor love, barely crossed. 7.
We know well that here we are missing a vertebra. We know well, we who are of the narrowest root, of the most precise rockery, that to touch the sun one must carry on standing, and naked no doubt. Oh, evidence in this hollow of our being, this repulsive emptiness of our conscience, in this lack of our vertebrae, even as bowed we advanced, stumbling and glorious, so that the marrow could pass, the trauma and the cosmos. We know well that here we must place the word, the most exact word for the closest connection, the word to invent, to build, to steal, in which God, which mob, the transfigured vertebra. For now, amid so much barking, we must be sure of our ankles. We take watch of our brothers, we take watch of our hopes, we take watch of our own transfiguration. Oh, Jacques, Patrick, Ahmed, Mustafa, Mohamed, Cesar, Vallejo, oh, a bit of saliva on this page. To hold fast for 1 hour, one more, all the way to the uncertain father, the son, the Taos bird, the word. Thank you.
Incredible. Thank you so much for that, Yolande. Our final reader, before we get into a conversation, is Yasmin Seal. Yasmin's work includes poetry, translation, criticism, and visual art. Among her translations from Arabic are the annotated Arabian Nights and Something Evergreen Called Life, a collection of poems by Rania Mamoun. She is the co-author of Agitated Air, a collaboration with Robin Moger, responding to the visionary poet and metaphysician Ibn Arabi. And she has held fellowships at the Institute for Ideas and Imagination in Paris and at the Coleman Center for Scholars and Writers at the New York Public Library. She currently teaches at Columbia University. Yasmin, welcome.
Thank you so much, Eric, and what fabulously difficult acts to follow, all of you. You're incredible. I thought I would give you a slice of some work in progress. I'll read two poems, each from a different book that I've been working on. They're both translations from classical Arabic, meaning written before the 19th century. They're quite different. One is a book of grief and one is a book of love. I'll begin with the grief. The first poem is by Al-Khansa. Al-Khansa was a tribeswoman who lived in the desert in eastern Arabia in the 7th century, just before the emergence of Islam. Her poems are, among other things, the last expression of a worldview that was about to be displaced by Islam's revolutionary vision. She is perhaps the best-known woman in the poetic tradition, the most influential, the most vivid, even to this day. About 40 of her poems have been preserved, which is quite extraordinary for the period. She wrote elegies, poems of mourning for her two brothers who were killed in battle with another tribe. Elegy was a genre reserved for women whose role it was to compose lamentations for the dead. This is a poem on the death of her brother, whose name was Sakhr. Be lavish, I, with tears. Let them rain when you cry for Sakhr with your tears. Let it be too much. No sleep, no shutting eyes all night. It's like grit under lids, like coal. And I am watching stars, their self-appointed watch. Sometimes I wear torn clothes. I heard the news, grim-faced, from the lips of the one come to break it. Sakhr, he said, over there, in a grave where he fell among stones. Go, and may God not be far from a man who set wrongs right, who got even. You had a heart untouched by fear, set in a line of steel. Like the flash of a spear in the night, your bitter resolve, the free son of free men. I will weep for you as long as ringdoves cry and stars brighten the roamer's way. And I will not make peace with those you fought until black pitch turns white. Now for some love. The next poem was written 400 years later in the great city of Córdoba in the 11th century. Córdoba, which was at the time the largest and wealthiest city in Europe, a great city of culture, especially of music and poetry, and a city where the three great Abrahamic religions were cohabiting in relative harmony. And out of this coexistence, I think, emerged a particularly brilliant artistic culture. This poem is from a book called The Ring of the Dove, which was written exactly 1,000 years ago by a young man called Ibn Hazm. It's a book on the nature of love, part philosophy, part autobiography, but full of the author's own poems, which he ended up disowning later in life. But it's a masterpiece. This is one. I love it when in talk his name comes up, like smelling amber suddenly. And if he speaks, I stop listening to those beside me, occupied with looking only at him, charming, flirting. And if I had with me even the caliph, I would not change course. And if I was forced to go, it would be often turning and stumbling as if wounded and with eyes fixed on him, even as my body pulled away. And I go down remembering how far he is, like someone caught in soft wet ground or fire and slowly dying. And if you ask if there is hope for heaven, there is, and I know the way up. Thank you.
Incredible. Thank you all to all four of our readers. A little bit hard to follow that, in fact, with the conversation, but marvelous. Fortunately, they're going to guide us through it here as well. And just a reminder, too, that you can find, as Kathleen mentioned, you can find work by Kathleen, John, Yasmin, and hopefully shortly Yolande on wordswithoutborders.org if you're interested in reading more of their work, where you can also find audio recordings of several poets reading both in the original language and in translation as well. So I thought I'd like to start us off by talking about beginnings. When it comes to translating poetry, how is it that you settle upon a project? Sort of what is the philosophy, perhaps, that animates your work? Who wants to start? That's to anyone. Yasmin.
I mean, I'll just say both the projects I read from were both commissions. Most of the projects I end up working on are proposed to me. They find me. I don't choose them. And I actually really enjoy that, being told, this is something you should take an interest in. This is something you should do. And having to find my own connection to that material rather than be guided by what I already know or what I think I already like.
In Yolande, Kathleen, is that a similar process for you, or do you tend to start somewhere else?
Completely the opposite for me. well, kind of. I started with Jean Sénac in undergrad. I had one of my mom's colleagues was like, oh, like you're thinking about translation. Have you ever heard of this guy? And I was like, no. And I read it, and I loved it, so I started playing with it. And then that led me to everything else, but I've been working on him for 100 years now.
Yeah. All right. Well, you look really great for having worked on it for 100 years. I'm amazed. That's quite the time travel as well. Kathleen?
Yeah, mine's probably some combination thereof of sometimes something will come to me, and then also Zufall or like kind of accident, something aleatory that I'll find either from a recommendation. I can thank a dear friend, poet colleague, translator Jörg Wiedemann for introducing me to Marie T. Martin's work, which I just became enthralled by. And I also do want to thank the Berlin Senate for support in doing some initial work on this project, which I would be happy to find a home too for these poems. But I've had also, with the Merritt Oppenheim book, that was quite unusual that her work had been translated into Romance languages in the 80s, but not yet into English. And I was doing something for a project for a Swiss publisher for something related to her letters, and then discovered the poems and
was able to get a grant to support that. So,
well, and so you discovered that too. I mean, I know you have several Romance languages as well. Yeah. So is that how you came to her work through these other translations?
Through a project where I was commissioned to translate some of the things from her archives, or Nachlass, that word came up the other day. Got some colleagues in the audience. And then from Romance languages, then it was also sometimes just finding a book, being in Santiago de Chile and finding this wonderful poet, Gustavo Barrera Calderón, who's done this really wonderful work that's really kind of at an intersection of liminality around gender and class and sexuality. And yeah, so some combination thereof, but I had really appreciated that Eric had shared with us in this panel a wonderful essay John had written for the Poetry Foundation for Harriet, right? Mm-hmm. I think, where he was talking about representation and translation, and I think practicalities often get forgotten about how these things happen, and those are certainly factors which influence the work I do, which is problematic in terms of the structures that then enact that, meaning that I live in Germany, which is a tax-rich country even relative to the EU. So that means that facilitates certain kinds of translations that maybe couldn't happen in other places as a working-class artist and translator myself. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I wonder if some of the rest of you would have something to say about that too, in terms of like the forms of support and like, I mean, for those here who aren't familiar, sort of like how a translation comes to life, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it's not just simply much as we would all love to do passion projects all day. That's only a component of it, right? So how do these things come to be?
Sorry. Well, I'll say that for me it varies. So a number of the poets that I've translated have been poets that I kind of either sought out or someone suggested to me. So to give you one example, with Ricardo Aleixo, had seen his name before. I hadn't read his poetry, and then we ended up being friends on Facebook when I was still really kind of active on Facebook. And I was like, who is this person? And so then I went and looked for his work, and I came across that poem, A Serpenti. And one of the things I'm really sort of interested in is kind of the impossibility of translating poetry, right? Poetry it can be very, very difficult to translate. And as I was saying with the poem about Cecil Taylor, in Portuguese, just give you an example of the challenge, in Portuguese, the poem has these two words towards the end, eu sou, I am, and eu sou, I sound. I mean, I do sound. But of course, it's like, a Portuguese reader would both see them and hear them and know the difference and get the play. But in English, am and sound are two completely different words. So I realized that, I had to come up with that do, I do sound, to capture some sense of the rhythm and the finality of the other word. But anyway, I'll say, a number of the poets that I've translated have been poets that I've kind of sort of sought out, or in the case, to give example of another Brazilian poet, Claudio Roquechi Pinto, when I was at Northwestern University, it was part of something called the Poetry and Poetics Colloquium, and they would bring writers in, and she was coming in, they were going to bring Claudia in, and so they said, we need someone to translate her poetry. And so they kind of looked around the room, and they were like, John, do you want to do it? And I said, oh, of course I'll do it, right? But anyway, she was wonderful to work with. And even in the, when she came and we, I had my translations, and we talked them through in real time, I found I was learning quite a bit about what she was doing, even beyond what I thought I knew. I think, I feel like I have some leeway in terms of, what to translate. And what I try to do usually is to pick writers who would not otherwise be translated, who are not receiving a lot of attention in terms of the translation world.
Sure.
In the U.S.
And I'd love to get, I think we'll get into that a little bit more too, this question of what you all feel is important to translate and sort of how that ends up playing out. And I'll just say, personally, I think we're all grateful that you persisted with A Serpenti even after clearly realizing the challenges therein. Returning for a second to the question sort of practicalities too, in terms of the forms of support that translators have or might have for their work. I mean, Yasmin, for example, I know you were at the Coleman Center last year as well. I don't know if it was, in fact, to work on a, I'm trying to remember, on a translation.
I was working on a few different things. I've been lucky to have support from fellowships of different kinds for the last 2 years. But since Kathleen mentioned practicalities, I thought I'd mention the last published translation that I have is a collection of poems by an extraordinary Sudanese writer called Rania Matmoun. And that came about because Rania had to leave Sudan. There was a revolutionary uprising in 2019 that Rania had been very involved in instigating. She was part of the revolutionary committees agitating for political change under the dictatorship. She found asylum in the US and was supported by an organization called City of Asylum, who do extraordinary work. They're based in Pittsburgh, and they provide support to writers who've had to leave their countries because of their writing, and they give them housing in Pittsburgh. So there's this extraordinary street, which must be the most interesting street in America, where living side by side are an incredible poet from Venezuela, an incredible poet from Myanmar, a poet from Sudan, and they are neighbors and continuing to make work, and City of Asylum really is allowing them to establish themselves as writers in this country. Rania arrived in the US having mainly written fiction and journalism back in Sudan, and having moved to the US, began writing poetry for some reason, and was very, very prolifically writing poetry almost daily. She would write a poem almost every day. Around that time, City of Asylum were trying to get her a kind of visa, which would mean that she could stay more permanently in this country, and needed to prove that she was... what is the incredible phrase? The visa,
an alien of
extraordinary ability. And in order to prove that Rania was an alien of extraordinary ability, they had to have some of her work translated into English, so that an immigration official could make that call. And so at that point, City of Asylum reached out to me and said, "We need to get some of this work translated." So initially, the readership for that, for her body of poetic work, was an immigration official who was going to decide whether or not to give her the visa. But having translated 100 poems and got to know Rania pretty well, I thought, well, maybe we should enlarge the circle of readers for your poetry beyond a couple of people in the State Department. So that's how it became a book.
Amazing. Glad those didn't stay with the State Department alone, for sure. Well, so, I mean, something that's sort of common to all of your work, in a sense, too, I mean, if we just think about Rania and then the work you were reading, Yasmin, is that you're often moving between texts and writers, I mean, different styles, different eras, you know, and different literary translations that are extremely well represented in English, and some, you know, that may have few or absolutely no writers with work available to English readers. I wonder how that differs, you know, each of those experiences differ, and if you could speak to that at all. I don't know, Kathleen, if you want to start that, thinking of moving between Oppenheim and Marie T. Martin, for example.
Yeah, and I'll be the exception, perhaps, that proves the rule, because curiously, actually, she has a poem in her collection that's called Wandelung, and also talks about a Steinfrau, or a stone woman, and it's very clear to me that Martin was in dialogue with Merit Oppenheim's visual art and poetry, and perhaps that was also why I was drawn to the work itself. And there really is something kind of intimate. I spoke, I guess, about this briefly when I was reading, that I'd be curious to hear from the other translator artists. You know, I think there is this kind of intimacy that part of in the practicalities is also an important practicality in life of love, like the kind of inimitable liminal space of really connecting to the work in a bodily sense. And I don't mean falling in love with the author, which would be quite strange, but the text, you know, like really connecting to the text in this way where I have this experience oftentimes that I can hear it in a way that doesn't have a barrier. I mean, I think we have this with books, right? Even in our mother tongues, we'll read a novel maybe and then put it down after half an hour, and then there's one or a poetry collection that will just breeze through. And I've had this with both Spanish and German language writers that I've translated, that
this sense that there's not very much mediation around the mechanism of the grammar of the language, or that as a barrier. So that's been kind of maybe one of the guiding principles. And me iro por las ramas. We were talking about idioms last night. I've gotten off track being from the southern U.S. and liking to tell an indirect story. So I'll bring it back home by saying that, yeah, so in this case, unusually, it was maybe quite connected. But I'm sure other people have other experiences.
Is that anybody else in terms of those experiences too, like moving between?
I'm thinking about, like, the work that I spend most of my time on is work that is either just completely unavailable in English or has been very, very lightly translated, and often, I hate to say this, but not well, like, you know, and that was enough for me to really want to champion that work. And, you know, just because of the nature of North Africa and its relationship with France and, you know, all of that joy of colonization and decolonization and all that stuff, there's already this like intense relationship between North Africans writing in French to begin with, right? And like what to do with that, and what French publishers would do with that, and then whether or not they would even want to continue that journey into another language, right? Like, and champion that work elsewhere, because it's hard enough to sort of get it going in the Francophone world, just because of where it's from. So for me, like, yeah, that just became a sort of driving force. But what's kind of fun, I think, is the fact that, because if I am maybe the first person doing some of this stuff or a lot of this stuff, like, that feels quite liberating to me. And I sort of view translation as just another interpretation of a text, right? So I get to interpret it however I feel like it should be interpreted, and then I get to sort of put that out there and see what happens. So it's really kind of liberating not to have anything else shadowing over how I'm thinking about it.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious too, for any of those who have, in fact, if you're not the first to arrive at, whether in English or, you know, we've talked about some of you had access to these translations in other languages that you read as well. Do you find that, you know, liberating, freeing, completely irrelevant?
Well, I'll say most of the writers that I translate, interestingly enough, have not tended to be translated. And I think, for example, of Hilde Ilst, the great Brazilian 20th century writer. And I actually, the internet, I came across her work on one of those old Angel Fire sites that one of her assistants or something had set up in the late 90s. And I started reading through it, and some of her work had been translated into French, I believe Spanish, I think Italian, and I was like, who is this person? And the work was quite shocking. I'll just tell you, Ilse was, you know, kind of working on her own plane, so to speak. And so I was fascinated, but I thought, okay, someone is probably working on this. And it wasn't actually until maybe a decade later, when Nightboat Books actually asked me to write the introduction to a translation by the great Canadian-U.S. poet Nathaniel, in conjunction with the Brazilian poet and publisher Rachel Gontijo Araújo. They did a translation of The Obscene Madame D, and then came back to me for the second Ilse book they had gotten the rights to, Letters from a Seducer. And I'll just say that you know, when I look at that translation, I see little things that I could change, but I'm actually really happy to have been one of the people to bring Hilde Ilst into English, because I feel like this is a writer who is so distinctive and so unlike the sorts of writers that the U.S. publishing industry tends to translate or tends to, you know, be interested in. Ilst was an extraordinary poet, and also a fiction, very, very innovative fiction writer, and also wrote plays. So to be able to bring her work into English, I felt like I was doing some kind of cosmic justice. But it tends to be the case of most of the writers that I translate. I just give you one other example. I even sometimes will translate writers from languages that I don't know as well. So one time I was at the International Book Fair in Santo Domingo, and I came across this book called, late great actress Dorothy Dandridge, and it was like, you know, Dorothy Dandridge, and I was like, who is this by? And it turns out it was by an Afro-Dominican poet, Mateo Morrison. And the book is this incredibly moving book about being a Black Dominican and looking at the poems, you know, the movies that are coming from the United States, right? The few at that time, the 50s and 60s, the few movies that are coming from the United States that have Black characters in them animate and help animate his world and his sense of self. So I thought, oh my God, this is an interesting conversation that I never see being discussed. So I translated some of the poems and he approved them. And then just one last example, some years ago I was in Amsterdam, and there's an amazing poetry bookstore there. I hope it's still there. And I was browsing through the bookshelves, and I came across a book by a young Moroccan Dutch poet, Mustapha Stitu. And I don't speak Dutch or write Dutch, but I taught myself a little Dutch, and I said I'm going to translate some of these poems. And so I translated some of these poems, and I posted them on. I had used to blog all the time, and I posted them on my blog. And someone actually wrote and said, "Oh my God, I know Mustapha Stitu. I'm going to tell him that you translated one." And I was like so moved by that, because someone actually like found this obscure blog, and was so happy that someone had translated his work. You know, so I think, you know, but of course, you know, this is many years later. No one, as far as I know, no one still translated Mustapha Stitu's work. And I mean, he's got a huge body of work now, I think. But I mean, this is one of the important writers in Dutch, contemporary Dutch, but also North African. So, to me, it's important, to do this kind of work, because you know, you never know who you might be opening up a dialogue for and with.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
I love the phrase "cosmic justice." Mm-hmm. I really feel that with Arabic, which is, you know, one of the great languages and literatures of the world, and is also an extremely long and rich tradition stretching over 1,500 years. And the language has not changed very much in that time. So you can read a poem from the 7th century, and it will be speaking to you pretty immediately, which means that if you translate from Arabic, you have access to this extraordinary pool of poetry, most of which is unknown in English. And that which has been already translated into English usually has been translated by academics, by specialists, for other specialists. And so what you get is a kind of gloss of the poem, you get a kind of account of what the poem is doing, but you don't really get a poem, and you certainly don't get a poem. Often the way I think people who are specialists of classical Arabic tend to translate is as if modernism had never happened. So they translate into a sort of pastiche of 19th century English poetry, which is no closer to the world of 7th century Arabia, but is part of a kind of idea of how old poetry should be translated. Mm-hmm. It gives it a kind of flavor of antiquity, which is a kind of false flavor of what the actual poem is like. In fact, when you read the 7th century Arabic poem, it feels extremely fresh and plain and spare. And Arabic is a language that's incredibly swift and precise and compressed. And it has that quality in common with English, so it's actually a useful combination to work in, because Arabic, you know, English has some of the same tools and resources that Arabic has. So it does feel like opening a treasure chest, you know, and saying, well, there's this incredible masterpiece and this extraordinary poet that you've never heard of. You know, and the two poets that I was reading from are canonical in Arabic. They are considered, they're very well known, and they're really part of the classical repertoire, and are barely read and barely known in English. So it feels like it's a very luxurious position of being able to introduce people to really great figures.
So I wonder, Yasmin, if I can follow up on that. What do you attribute that to, the fact that in English they're not known, if they are in fact sort of these, you know, they're sort of cornerstones of the Arabic language tradition.
I think it's because of this way that they've been translated, which means that they haven't... classical Arabic poetry has not really, with very few exceptions, it has not really entered the pool of world poetry that contemporary English language poets might draw from in the way that happened with Chinese poetry in the early 20th century with Ezra Pound and that whole kind of modernist moment. There are other poetries in other languages that have been translated in a way that makes them available, I think, or makes them makes contemporary poets feel like these are their contemporaries, or these are poets that they can be in conversation with. Arabic, for a number of reasons, has remained within this circle of specialists. So that's my agenda to try and...
Down with translationese.
Absolutely. I mean, have the rest of you come across this at all? Like, where you sort of, you know, you've noticed that, I guess, where there are existing, you know, sort of extant translations, where you just find them sort of lacking and you felt a need to, you know, return to them and sort of bring them in a, you know, shed a new light and perhaps a more, I'm entering very dangerous territory, but a more faithful.
Well,
a more faithful rendering.
I could piggyback and ping pong off of some of what was just said, which is, you know, John was talking about this. I actually think translators are a lot like car mechanics, although I say that and I realize I don't even know how to change the tire, so that's maybe the metaphor has become. But, you know, I think this idea, there's sometimes a mis, in my view, a misunderstanding that translation is about the specialization of the knowledge of the so-called source language or original language that you're working with. And I think it's really, you know, car mechanics don't know how every single make and model under the sun operate. They know how to make the car run well and to hear the engine and to adjust the mechanisms until it works. And language is a mechanism and a system. And poetry, every poem that is written that is a system and machine, a beautiful machine that sort of builds and composes, and then the car stops when the poem ends. Mm-hmm. And so I think you really can translate from all kinds of languages. You don't know if you have enough information at access, and of course with a lot of humility and respect. But it's that kind of curiosity that actually I think makes for good translations. And you know, you're talking about this leanness and activation, and it's only when we start to kind of condescend and put these really fusty ideas. I mean, we of course know that we can do, you know, that Shakespeare is modern. Why wouldn't, you know, classical Arabic also be? And to, you know, let's get rid of some of this kind of fustiness around treating translation as a specialized thing that's required only for experts. Like, yeah.
Yeah. I'll just say that, you know, one of my favorite writers, Brazilian writers, Clarice Lispector, you know, I remember reading she had translated Shakespeare and all these people, and I was thinking, okay, something tells me that everything that Clarice Lispector probably translated into Portuguese probably sounds like Clarice Lispector, right? which is something, right? You know, it's not nothing. But yeah, I mean, I can't say that there's any. I mean, most of the people that I've translated, if someone else has translated them, they've done a very good job. I will say I had one of the Brazilian writers who I really love, Ana Cristina Cesar. You know, I went to the New York Public Library and found this book, basically this huge book that had a bunch of facsimile editions of her work, you know, in draft form. And I thought, okay, you know, someone's translating, I think it was Brenda Hillman and her mother did a beautiful translation of kind of the series of Ana Cristina Cesar's books. And I thought, well, I'm going to actually, since they're doing, you know, kind of the books that kind of... went out into the wider world, I'm going to look at some of these drafts and things and translate them. And that was a lot of fun because it was like, you know, no one's going to see this. But it also gave me a sort of an insight into Ana Cristina Cesar's poetry, her mind, and the world she was living in, which was, I think, a kind of education in and of itself. And I did that just for myself. But yes, I mean, sometimes even bad translations, our translations that aren't so great or aren't so faithful have an extraordinary impact. And I'll say, speaking, going back to Lispector, so many people read those earlier translations of Clarice Lispector's work and fell in love with her. And there's so many to be said for that. The new set of translations that New Directions, I think, pretty much commissioned, are, to my mind, and I think, you know, people have said this, are in many cases much better, right? You know, in fact, in certain cases, they actually restore language that was removed. I'm always amazed when people are saying, oh yeah, you know, I came across the original, I was reading the original, and they left out like paragraphs, right? This, I'm like, how did you leave out a paragraph? Right, but I say all this to say that, I mean, you know, both the earlier works, for all their faults, and the newer work, which, you know, gives, I think, probably a much better sense of, you know, Clarice Lispector's language in Portuguese, in English, are important. So it's something to be said for both.
Well, it's interesting you bring up this question of like missing paragraphs and whatnot, because it's certainly not the first time I've heard that too, and I've always wondered, and perhaps somebody knows the answer to this, whether here or on the radio, and, you know. So if you can somehow call in your answer, this is what we need. We need a call-in show, Jeffrey, next time. Which is, you know, how those things happen, and you know, John, you had mentioned earlier, sort of, you know, the obstacles to translation, to work in translation, coming into English, mm-hmm. relate a lot to sort of, I guess what you can call sort of tastes or expectations about mm-hmm. From Anglophone publishers about what mm-hmm. literature should do, mm-hmm. and you know, I suspect at least in some of those cases that in fact missing paragraphs and such, in fact they're not missing per se in right. the sense of like, mm-hmm. you know, they weren't mistakes, they weren't accidentally left out. Right. And I wonder if any of you have come across that as you're doing like retranslation projects or anything like that. Maybe not. All right. So we'll move on first. But I mean, I getting at that question from another angle, which I think is important too. I think we've sort of been skirting around a question. Which is of translation and work in translation often getting siloed sort of as almost as a separate genre. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you know, I mean, I'm not the first person to make that observation. I mean, you even go to your bookstore and you know, even in, you know, down the city or wherever, and often things are set up as like, oh, here's our translated literature section. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, my question is, you know, what impact does that have on what is translated, and also how it's received? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I would hazard that those translated literature sections of bookstores like don't have the things that we would consider canonical in English, even though they were translated, mm-hmm. right? I'm sure that the Odyssey is not there. Right, like among you know, countless other things. So, yeah, I mean, I think like there are certain literatures and languages that we've deemed belong to us culturally, in a sense, perhaps, especially I think in the United States, and then others that we just must always stamp as not ours, right, for various reasons, which is a whole different panel discussion. But, you know, I'm thinking about the translations that Yasmin was talking about being done by experts for other experts. And I wonder two things. I mean, first of all, that sounds a little bit to me the way that English language films that are about foreign locations will use English accents to like denote people speaking in a different language, right? Like that reminded me of that. But also it just makes me wonder if they were poets translating these poems, and then what happens when they aren't poets translating poems. And like, I have lots of feelings and thoughts about that, but I think there's definitely a relationship there between like why they're doing it, how they're doing it, who they're doing it for, obviously, but then like the why being tied to information maybe rather than art, or like a sort of informational transaction rather than like a poetic mm-hmm. transaction, yes. if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that desire to distinguish between literature and literature in translation is perhaps also to do with an anxiety about not getting the real thing. You know, people want to know that what they're reading is actually Tolstoy rather than Tolstoy seen through some kind of veil, which I think is a kind of misconception of what translation is, that you're never getting the real thing. You're getting this encounter, which is what's beautiful about it, between two writers, the translator and this other author, and it's a kind of dance between them. And, you know, working with very ancient literature, I feel somewhat liberated from some of these concerns because the text itself is already so remote in time and in space that I think there's perhaps less that anxiety, and perhaps people are grateful for the translator's role in sort of ferrying that work to us. But with more contemporary work, I know there is sometimes this phenomenon of publishers trying to conceal the fact that it's a translation, as if people might feel somewhat robbed if they found out that they were not, in fact, getting Elena Ferrante or whoever it is. Yeah.
For sure. Well, I mean, I'd like to talk about a moment for, I mean, I think what we're also talking about here is the question of who translates. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what is a project? Who is the translator on it? And, you know, some of us here will be familiar, whether it's with Emily Wilson's recent Odyssey and Iliad translations, even Yasmin, you know, with the 1001 Nights, your retranslations. And, you know, the focus sort of also coming to the fact that you were the first woman to translate that into English. Emily Wilson, I believe, in fact, she's debunked the fact that she was the first.
She was the first woman to do it into English.
To do it into, yep. But at any rate, you know, I guess the question is, does it matter who is doing the translating and how?
I mean, the subjectivity is always going to come into it, and I think the important thing is to remember that that subjectivity is always present, even when it's Robert Fagel's. I remember watching just actually a few months ago, because I love Emily Wilson's translation, an interview with her with someone over YouTube, and she handled this, I think, with a lot of grace and sensitivity, but someone said to her, the interviewer said, you know, well, how does it feel to be, you know, how does your femaleness come into translating this text? And she rightfully, she answered that and had some things to say about it, but also rightfully pointed out that someone like Robert Fagel's is not an invisible body when he's mm-hmm. translating. There's just reasons around power for which we ascribe that sense. I think, as you were saying, Yolande, like also that, you know, there is this sense of being able to, we shouldn't feel anxiety around the subjectivity or that that's part of what comes in. I mean, translation is also an interpretation, and in that sense, it's a, you know, it is a kind of acting, perhaps. Maybe not everyone would feel that way, but yeah.
Well, I'll just say, I agree with you, with everything you all are saying. And one of the things I also want to say is that identity is not always, is not determinative. But sometimes, of course, you may, even if you come from there's a kind of resonance that, you know, that you as a translator have, that a very good translator who is not from a similar background than from the person that they're translating may miss. And so we talked about this last night with, and I'll just make it very brief, with the Brazilian fiction writer, Paulo Scott, who's Afro-Brazilian from the very far south of part of Brazil. And he has a book, Marrom e Amarelo, which translates roughly to brown and yellow. And so the British and English U.S. publisher translated it, the title into Phenotypes. But as soon as I saw that title and knew who was, you know, read a little bit in Portuguese of what he was writing, my first thought was this is a direct analog in for Black Americans. There would be, you know, light skin, dark skin, right? And so I said this to the, I wrote this to the publisher. I said, you know, I think the translation is fantastic. I said, it's fantastic. And he was like, oh, you know, we didn't think of that. But that's, but as soon as I saw that, so I mean, I think sometimes, you know, you can bring something that you don't even imagine that you're bringing to the translation. But again, I don't think that one's identity or identifications, you know, have to be or are always determinative.
And just thinking about Yolande's question about whether the translator was a poet or not, I think of poet as being a sort of identity marker in the same way. And, you know, in some ways, translating some of the Arabic work that I read to you, being a poet is maybe most important, you know, more important than being a woman or anything else in terms of the kind of musical and rhythmic sensibility that you bring to the work, since we're talking about poetry, which is so important, but often in the translation of poetry, particularly from older periods, is treated as a kind of accessory to the poem rather than something that's integral to it, as if it was some kind of ornament or decoration laid over the poem rather than what the poem is made of.
Well, so the event description here refers to the challenges of finding readers for poetry, which I think is not unrelated, in fact, to everything we're sort of been talking about. And so I wonder what does that mean? What have you found that to mean in each of your cases. And if I can maybe start by bringing in something, Yasmin, that I think you said in an interview a few years ago, in which you said that often you felt that the marketing of Arabic language literature was like trying to get people to eat their vegetables. So where do we go from there?
Yeah, I think what I meant by that was that pleasure is very important. Mm-hmm. Reading literature shouldn't feel like a chore, or you shouldn't be selling it that way, as if it was some kind of political self-improvement or something, that, you know, I need to read an Arabic novel to improve myself. My hope, and the way that I hope to find readers, particularly translating poetry, is transmitting the current of feeling that I feel mm-hmm. is in the poem. Translation for me is to do with movement and flow and flux and this kind of electricity passing between people through their texts. So if I feel that I've managed to convey that in the English, then I feel that that text will find its readers in a somewhat mysterious way. You know, I don't. But I feel like my work is done if I've been able to capture that in English.
Well, so, go ahead, okay. John. Great, okay. Terrific.
Now, I'm just going to say, the thing I always try to keep in mind is that there are, you know, sometimes we think there isn't a large body of people out there who love poetry, but quite a few people out there are reading poetry, writing poetry, and interested in learning about new poets. And so the challenge, I'm not involved in the publishing, I'm not a publisher, but I think one of the things that I always try to say to people I know who are involved in publishing is to just kind of, you know, keep your eyes open and look, because there's actually a larger audience for the work, particularly work in translation, but poetry in general, than you might imagine. Especially, let me just add, especially poetry that speaks to the current moment, right? That speaks to what's happening, that speaks to the issues that we're sort of grappling with as a society. There are quite a few excellent poets writing in English, and of course, writing in languages other than English, and making that work available, I think there are large audiences out there for it.
Absolutely. So, well, we have quite a few attendees here today, and so I think maybe what we can do is turn it over for audience questions. So what I'm going to ask for those of you who do have questions, please keep your questions concise, because I'll have to repeat them so that our listeners over the radio can hear them as well. And I'm afraid my short-term memory is not what I wish it were. Please. So the question is where would you recommend starting reading poetry in translation? And the question was whether I would recommend Words Without Borders, which, of course, I will absolutely shamelessly say, go to wordswithoutborders.org. It is a wonderful place. There are also a lot of other terrific publishers doing great work. But yeah,
like
how...
Flowchart.
Exactly, like Flowchart, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Who wants to take that? Where would you recommend somebody? And maybe if we were to tweak that a bit, you know, who, and it can be from, you know, the tradition to translate from, or more generally, where would you recommend somebody get started? Maybe, if we want, we could do a recommendation each of a writer or a book or whatever.
Oh, okay.
Is that too? Am I putting you all on the spot? However you want to take that.
Well, I would say, what is important to you
yeah.
as a writer? Mm-hmm. Whatever issues are important to you, there are probably writers whose work is in translation speaking to those issues. So that might be one place to start.
Great. Anyone else?
Flowchart Foundation does close readings in a personal space with contemporary poets, where oftentimes the work examined is in translation, and those events one can tune in either live over audio video conferencing, or they are also always archived, so you could kind of look through their archive and look at that. And then another, I think, because I do think chance is actually one of the delights in encountering, mm-hmm. and that pleasure is a huge component. And I think things like the Academy of American Poets, mm-hmm. Daily Poems, or Poetry Daily, you know, that there's a way in which they feature work also in translation, mm-hmm. is a great way to sort of discover something without having to know which needle and then which haystack you're searching mm-hmm. for.
Yeah, and yeah. Jeffrey, I think you mentioned too earlier, Penn Sound, of course, too, as an audio archive. Mm-hmm.
And just to mention one more poetry newsletter, just because when a poem drops into your inbox every day, you're more likely to read it than if you have to go out looking for it. There's a wonderful translator from Spanish called Robin Myers, mm-hmm. who has a daily, she sends a poem every day to whoever subscribes. I think it's called Poem Per Diem.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And you can just put your email in, and she has wonderful taste, and many of those poems are in translation.
It's a terrific recommendation. For you first.
Yeah, there was resistance to your question before, but I'm going to try it again.
Okay.
If each of the translator artists would suggest one writer who is available in English translation that you think ought to be better known and that we ought to look for.
So the question is, if our translator poets could make one recommendation of a poet or a book that they feel has been overlooked or just that they feel is particularly enjoyable.
I'll recommend Umberto Saba's Scorciatoie, which are sort of, I'd say, at the intersection of poetry and prose poetry. They're these shortcuts or aphorisms that are just wonderfully humorous.
Well, I mentioned Ana Cristina Cesar, so I would say, you know, if you can get the book that Brenda Hillman and her mother translated. She's fantastic, and her work is quite playful, but also quite serious.
Mine is tough because I'm trying to be the person that brings it into English, and it's not all out there yet. We're working on that, but I would say Mohamed Dib, D-I-B. I've worked on his stuff. Most of it hasn't been translated, but I believe one of his sort of seminal texts has, and it's really beautiful.
This is a book that I think is about to come out. I've just written a blurb for it, so it's kind of fresh in my mind. There's a Palestinian poet called Najwan Darwish, and his collected poems are about to come out, translated very, very wonderfully by Karim James Abu Zaid. I can't remember the title of the collected poems, but it's coming soon. If you search for Najwan Darwish, it's a wonderful range of work, and it's very beautifully translated.
I think that's coming out from Yale, right?
Yes, exactly.
I'm remembering. And yeah. I'm going to be shameless again, you can find some of those poems on wordswithoutborders.org. We published a lot of Nashmin. Anyway, all right, I'll stop. I'm getting ridiculous. There's another question back here. So the question for those tuning in over the radio is, what is your relationship to the writers you work with, especially because, at least with poetry especially, it feels like that relationship has to be a conversation in a sense, which certainly for those of us who are working with deceased authors becomes a very interesting conversation.
I think the conversation happens on the page. That's a great question, and I think there's a real intimacy, a kind of, I don't know. I sort of imagine like holding a seashell to your ear and that there's this kind of quiet conversation. In the case of Marie T. Martin, we happen to be born in the same year, and that's a superficial detail and not deterministic, but it's somehow, there is when I'm working on her poems, this feeling of communion through the text, you know, that there's a dialogue and it's not about, I mean, hopefully projecting or something, but just about listening. And I think we as readers all know that. And I think probably as Yasmin said, you know, that the pleasure of poetry is partly also as readers, you know, I think something we come to as translators too, you know, and poets, that there's accessing that listening, that conversation happens between the page and the person encountering the words.
Well, I'll just say that I've translated both living and deceased authors. With the living authors, I've been fortunate usually to have some contact, sometimes only after I've done my translations and they want to see them. In other cases, I've worked with the authors. But sometimes it can be incredibly helpful because, and I know this as someone who's had my work translated. The translator may be very good, but they might still miss little things, you know, that are culturally embedded. And so to give one example, one of the first writers I ever translated was a Brazilian writer, Edmilson de Almeida Pereira, from a town called Juiz de Fora. And I thought I knew a little something about Afro-Brazilian religions. And so I, had translated some of his poems, and he was very kind. He's a very lovely person. He said, you know, John, actually, since he doesn't speak English, we communicate in French, right? We used to write letters and emails in French. And he says, you know, just so you know, I am Afro-Brazilian, but where I'm from, in Minas Gerais, the people are descended from people from the Congo, right? And the religious tradition is called Congado. And so I'm going to send you some books about Congado, right? With some of which he and his wife, one of which he and his wife had written, about this tradition. And, you know, please read these books. Of course, they were in Portuguese, right? So please read these books. And, but, you know, I think you're on the right track. It was very nice. And I was like, you know, so of course, you have the moment of complete and total humility because I was like, you know, I thought I knew what I was doing. But, I mean, that was a wonderful thing, too, because it was kind of opened up all kinds of doors for me, and, you know, in terms of learning about a new tradition that I didn't know about. But I think it can be incredibly helpful to be in dialogue with the writer if they're living, and sometimes if they're no longer with us, then I think I try to immerse myself in the world that they lived in so that I have some sense of where they might be coming from.
All right. And amazing, and I think we're going to have to end on that point, great point to end on as well. Like to thank all of you for coming, and those of you listening on the radio for coming as well. If you want more events like this, I know that Flowchart Foundation does quite a bit of them. Thanks again to D.W. Gibson and Art Omai Writers as well. And yes, hope to see you here at the next one. Thanks, everybody.